Let us pray. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles, and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Bliss. Amen. Welcome, everyone. I have something that's kind of funny. I get lots of things sent to me, and this one came from Charmy. It's entitled Point of View. It all depends on the way you look at things. One day, a father who is very wealthy took his son to a trip to the country with a firm purpose to show him how poor people can be. They spent a day and a night in the farm of a very poor family. When they got back from their trip, the father asked his son, "How was the trip? "Very good, Dad." "Did you see how poor people can be?" the father asked. "Yeah." "And what did you learn?" The son answered, "I saw that we have a dog at home, and they have four. We have a pool that reaches to the middle of the garden. They have a creek that has no end. We have imported lamps in the garden. They have stars. Our patio reaches to the front yard. They have a whole horizon." When the little boy was finishing, the father was speechless. His son added, "Thanks, Dad, for showing us how poor we are." That's lovely. The autobiography of a yogi. There was a Saint Vandaburi who was said to have been very wealthy, and he was asked, "Wasn't it difficult to give up all that wealth?" And he says, "You know, it's just the other way around." He says, "I gave up a few trinkets, and now I have immense spiritual wealth. I wouldn't trade it for anything else." I'd like to read from a book, Sri Ramakrishna, the Great Master, from the chapter 7, Sadhana and Divine Inebriation. The master became quite unfit for all work for some days, as his mind was absorbed in the bliss arising from the vision of the Divine Mother. It became impossible for him to perform regular worship and other duties of the temple. Haride somehow managed with the help of another Brahmana. He also thought of arranging for some treatment for his uncle, thinking that he was afflicted with insanity. He had become somehow acquainted with a physician of a princely house of the Bukhailas, under whose treatment he placed the master now. And knowing that there was no possibility of speedy recovery, he sent word to his mother and brother at Kamapakar. But the master himself attempted to perform the worship on days when he was comparatively free from the overpowering spiritual emotions and loss of outward consciousness from eagerness for God vision. He told us sometimes a little of the thoughts and experiences at the time of his worship and meditation in those days. He said, "I used to show to my mind the image of the Bhairavya in meditation pose on the parapet of the roof of the music hall and say to it, 'You must be firm and motionless like that and meditate on the mother's lotus feet. No sooner had I sat down for meditation than I heard clattering sounds produced in the joints of my body and limbs from the direction of the legs upwards. They got locked one after another, as if someone from within turned the keys. As long as I meditated, I had no power to move my body and change my posture even slightly, or give up meditation, or go elsewhere, or do anything else at will. I was, as it were, forcibly made to sit in the same posture, as long as the joints did not make clattering sounds as before and were unlocked, this time from the direction from the head to the legs. When I sat and meditated, I had in the beginning the vision of particles of light like groups of fireflies. I saw sometimes all quarters covered with masses of mist-like light. And at other times I perceived that all things were pervaded by bright waves of light like molten silver. I saw these things sometimes with my eyes shut and sometimes with my eyes open. I did not understand what I saw, nor did I know whether it was good or bad to have such visions. I therefore prayed to Mother with a troubled heart. I don't understand, Mother, what is happening to me. I don't know mantras, etc., by which to call thee. Please teach me personally what may enable me to realize thee. Mother, if thou dost not teach me, what else will? For there is no refuge for me except thee. I used to pray thus with a concentrated mind and weep piteously on account of my eagerness of heart. The Master's worship, meditation, etc., underwent novel changes. It is difficult to explain how wholehearted and deep was his absorption in her. It was characterized by a childlike simplicity, sweetness, faith, and dependence on the mother, his sole stay and support. Free from the seriousness of an adult, he made no personal effort to observe the scriptural injunctions and prohibitions regarding time, place, and person, nor did he care to conduct himself in a manner conforming to standards approved of by the worldly and the godly. Whenever one saw him, one thought that he had merged his little will and his little ego in the will of her who was the source of all wills, and that he did everything as if he were completely an instrument in her hand, praying in his heart of hearts, O Mother, my only refuge, kindly make me, this boy, say and do what I should. It was natural that this marked variance of his conduct and behavior from what worldly people considered proper led to criticisms, at first in whispers and afterwards as loud gossip. But all these mattered little to him. For the boy of the Divine Mother that he was, he now moved about and did everything by her direction. The vain clamor of the world did not reach his ears at all, for though in the world he was not of it, the external world was now transformed for him into a dream world. Now he could not attribute substantiality to it in spite of his efforts. The universal mother's form, consisting of pure consciousness and bliss, was now to him the only reality. Previously, on some occasions at the time of worship and meditation, the Master used to see a hand of the Divine Mother or foot, bright and delicate, or her sweet, affectionate, and smiling face, supremely beautiful. Now he saw, even at times other than those of worship and meditation, the full figure of the effulgent Mother, smiling and speaking, guiding and accompanying him, and saying, "Do this. Don't do that." Formerly, when he offered cooked food, etc., to the mother, he used to see an extraordinary ray of light coming out, beaming from her eyes. It touched all the offered articles, took their essential parts, and withdrew itself into her eyes. Now he saw that even before the offering was made, The same mother in her very person sat down to take the offerings, illumining the temple with the effulgence of her holy presence. One day, Herode came suddenly at time of the worship and saw the master had his hands in the hands, saw that the master had in his hands an argia consisting of china roses and vilva leaves, which he was going to offer at the lotus feet of the Divine Mother. He was absorbed in thinking of her when he cried out suddenly, saying, "Wait, wait, let me utter the mantra first, and then thou wilt take it." He then offered the food ritually before finishing the worship. Previously, at the time of worship and meditation, he saw a wonderful living presence in the stone image before him. Now he did not see that image at all when he entered the temple, but saw instead standing there the living mother herself, all consciousness, with hands that offered boons and freedom from fear. The master said, "I put the palm of my hand near her nostrils and felt that the mother was actually breathing. I observed very closely, but I could never see the shadow of the mother's divine person on the temple wall in the light of the lamp at night. I heard from my room the jingling sounds of the mother's anklets as she went upstairs like a merry little girl. I came out to verify and found that she, with her hair disheveled, was actually standing on the veranda of the first floor of the temple and was now viewing Calcutta and next to the Ganga." "One felt awestruck," said Herode, "when one entered the Kali temple, even when the master was not there, let alone when he was. Yet I could not give up the temptation of seeing how the master behaved at the time of worship. When I suddenly came there on many occasions, filled my heart with awe and devotion. But doubt arose when I came out. I thought, has uncle really gone mad? Otherwise, why does he do such forbidden acts at the time of worship? I felt apprehensive about what the Rani and Mater Buba, Babu, would think and say when they came to know of it. But such thoughts never crossed my uncle's mind, nor did he give ear to what I told him about them. Again, I could not venture now to speak to him much. An indescribable fear and hesitation came and pressed my mouth. I knew not why. I felt an indefinable distance between him and me for some unknown reason. Having no other alternative left, I served him silently as far as I could." The description of a life of a saint and his internal experiences comes to the worldly-minded as a very strange thing indeed. But for anyone who has begun the great adventure of the inner journey, going from the human to the divine can recognize the hallmarks of true spiritual experiences. When Mother was at Anandashram in 1957 and 58, undergoing the mystical crucifixion, there were many there at the ashram, despite the fact that they were in a spiritual atmosphere, even as Ramakrishna was in a spiritual temple, who thought that she was going insane and ascribed her actions and what she was going through to that kind of experience. And so Ramakrishna also was thought to be going insane by many, and physicians were sent for in order to cure him of this malady. Of course, as we know from hindsight, the cure was actually not needed, because the malady was one of the destruction of the ego and the reconstruction of the divine self. In hearing of such descriptions, we may stand back in fear and certainly in awe of having to go through such experiences, as having to go against what other people might think. Herode here expresses the human ego in the sense of drawing back from disappointing others, making others think poorly of us, having their judgments against us, and so on. This fear is one of the greatest impediments that we come up against in terms of the spiritual path. It is actually the pride of the ego that keeps it in a state of separation. Because fundamentally what is behind that idea is that you and I are separate. If I am going through some experience and you find criticism and you speak that out to me or to other people, then I must feel ashamed. I must feel badly for that. I must feel perhaps that I am wrong for going through what I am going through. And on it goes. The fears just multiply over and again. And they're each particular to our own. You know, sometimes people have dreams, and in that dream, they're suddenly aware that they're standing on a stage without any clothes on, or they've come to some occasion and they're completely unprepared for whatever is going to occur. And they're right there, riveted, in front of all these other people in a state of shame. But what is shame, really? Shame is a conviction that we hold in our mind of how we ought to be or how other people will perceive us to be. We think of ourselves as being without error, perhaps. Now, we know very well in our conscious mind that we produce errors every day. We make mistakes. But there's some place deep inside of us that doesn't allow for that, and in fact does a full-time job of anticipating anything that might come our way that would produce some embarrassment, some shame for us. And if we were caught in that field of shame, then we would feel like just dropping into the floor and disappearing from existence. This sense of shame, this sense of wanting to disappear, even goes back to the time of Adam and Eve at the garden where they were in their pristine spiritual mode and they were in communion with God at all times. And due to their eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, in other words, they entered into a conscious awareness of duality. Good and evil, up and down, good and bad, all the rest, all the pairs of opposites are represented in this tree of knowledge of good and evil. And when they bit into that fruit, or when they began to absorb that idea of division, of separation, and God metaphorically came walking in through the garden, and they hid. Now, this is the first time that they were separated, you see, in this way. And what was the impulse? The impulse was to hide. God says, "Why did you hide?" He said, "We were ashamed." So you see where shame comes as a very fundamental aspect of our separation from our spiritual union, our spiritual consciousness. You know, we watch little children, and in the beginning, they're just wide open. They are unashamed. Whatever they do, whatever they speak, is just fine. And they're happy with that. But gradually, they learn, you may do this and you may not do that. When you do this, you're bad. When you do that, you're good. And that is necessary in order for them to enter into that. But that is entering into this idea of the knowledge of good and evil, good and bad. Some things are good to do, some things you withhold from doing. And then other children begin to pick up that, and they begin to shame other children. Not just for what they do, but who they are, how they express themselves. You don't talk right. You don't dress right. You look funny. And even if they don't, the chant is picked up by a group because there's just that group energy that begins to get generated in that way. And some kids, for whatever reason, seem to be more of a target of that than other children are. Some seem to be the instigators for that. And on it goes. And so this is the generation, the beginning of this sense of shame that gets so accentuated in our minds and begins to separate us one from the other. And it becomes to such a degree that I can't reveal myself to you because I'm ashamed that if you see who I am, you'll reject me, you'll humiliate me, you won't accept me as I truly am. Now, I grew up very shy, and I grew up in a kind of a household situation where it wasn't very safe oftentimes to be seen. And there was sometimes violence and sometimes more psychological kinds of oppression going on. And so I also hooked in with a pattern that I brought into this world. And I recoiled from that. I tried to hide from that. And so my expertise became hiding. I was tried to be socially acceptable on the inside, but I didn't ever want to voice my own opinions because I thought they might be different from somebody else's. Or if somebody else voiced strong opinions, I kind of went along with what they said, or at least I wouldn't disagree with them. Why? Because I didn't want to enter into the difference. I wanted to find a unity, an acceptance by other people. But that desire for acceptance also ruled out the possibility that I could be myself. And so I lived by a self-imposed tyranny. And the tyranny was a fear of rejection. One time when I had a horoscope read by Pam Kennard, who many of you met here, who came and gave a talk here, this is many years ago, and she gave me a long reading. I don't remember much of it, but one of the things that she said that I do remember is that she talked about the characteristics that I brought into this life. And that was a lot of metaphysical knowledge, a lot of spiritual understanding. But one of the things that I was to learn, one of the things I was to do in this lifetime to accomplish was to bring that out into the open, to show it to others, to be a teacher. Now, at that time, I wasn't giving talks, and I didn't hold that position in the group at all. But it foretold of what I was to do, even though I didn't fully know it or accept it at the time. And so Mother compounded it all when she asked me to start giving talks, and she said, "Speak from your own experience." Well, I had never spoken of my spiritual experiences to anybody, nor had I really revealed who I was emotionally or psychologically. I would speak to people, I would talk to them, I would express opinions if I thought it was all right, if I thought it was safe. But I didn't want to do it if I thought that there might be some vulnerability there on my part. So that was quite a challenge for me to start to speak from my own experience. Not only that, but I regarded my spiritual experiences as the most sacred things, the closest things that I had in my life. And it wasn't easy to bring those out into the open and to speak them to whoever was sitting there, to let them do with that whatever they did with it. And some at times found criticism with it. Some found inspiration with it. But, you know, for many years I was a presenter and a facilitator, and I would always do feedback forms. And I would get the feedback forms, and 9 out of 10 of them would be rave reviews, but 1 out of 100, perhaps, would be critical of something that I did, and it might even be mild criticism. I would give that more weight than all the 99 others, because that one was the one that resonated with the most tender spot in me. But through putting myself forward, through being a presenter, a teacher, through giving talks here, through opening myself up and giving of myself, a change began to happen. I began to get more focused on the inner sense of who I was in giving a talk. I was more aware of the flow of divine consciousness flowing through me as I spoke. That energy, that intelligence, everything was given to me. And I was also made aware of the quality, the feeling in the room that was made up by the collective consciousness of everyone who was there. And through that awareness, and only through that awareness, was I able to shift my attention from what I anticipated other people to think, how I thought they might find criticism with me, and I focused it on that divine consciousness and how it flowed through me. And with that came a great sense of freedom. To one degree, it didn't matter how other people received it, what they thought about it. And what I was focused on was the quality that flowed through me. You see, when I stand up before you, oftentimes, most times, my eyes are closed, even as mothers were. And what I experience is a continual flow of thoughts as if they're being just fed to me, one after the other. I have no idea what I'm going to say in the next moment. And I am attuned to that, and I feel the flow of divine power flowing through me, through my body, through my heart, through my third eye center, and so forth. And being lifted into that spiritual state, I am barely aware that I even have a body that is standing here. What I am more aware of is this divine consciousness as it flows through me. And from my perspective and what God has told me, this divine consciousness flows out and is shared with everybody who's in the room. And all those who attune their consciousness to it are lifted up into that spirit. And it is a way for God to give to God. It is a way for God to awaken God. And I don't say that from any sense that I do it, because I am all too aware that I do not do it. Certainly, it operates through my personality, through my brain. But oftentimes, I say things that I've never been aware of before. Sometimes after a talk, I remember something that I said, or somebody tells me something that I said, and then I think, well, I wonder if that's true. And then I think about it, and I meditate on it, and I wait for the confirmation of truth to come back to me. I don't accept it just because I said it. And this is really true for all of us. We shouldn't accept any truth just because someone said it, or just because we even have thought it. We must test every spirit that comes to us. Now, how do we test that spirit? We give it up to God. We say, God, you tell me the truth about this. And we don't get involved with our own intellect, because the intellect is limited in its information, but the divine consciousness is unlimited in its ability and its knowledge. And so we get quiet inside. We ask the question, and in that quietness, we wait for a response. And when that response comes to us, we feel the purity of it. We feel the perfection of it. And we can test it again and again until we become absolutely convinced through and through that this is the truth. Now, this is one way of testing the spirit. We all know people in different situations where somebody said, God told me this, or God showed me that. And one is at variance with another. What is the truth? The truth is something to be accessed within yourself. Because we're all being called upon to be saints. We're not here in order to be a mimic of somebody else. We're here to discover our own divine consciousness. Now, this is no easy task, and not all people are called to it. But those who are feel as if they have found a home, and that as if nothing else would ever quite fit. And it is through this dedication to this path. You see, Mother talked about a concept that I hadn't thought of much before meeting her, and that was loyalty. Now, like many words, such as discipline and, those kinds of concepts oftentimes got thrown out in the 60s as being not good. And I would say loyalty probably came along with that, because loyalty was seen to be blind. It was not questioning what was occurring. Now, that's not the kind of loyalty that we're speaking here. When I entered into the spiritual path and I discovered Mother, and through one experience after another, I grew into that acceptance that this was my spiritual path. I felt it in the beginning, but I couldn't fully accept it in my mind. I had to test it time after time after time. But as I tested it, it gradually grew in my mind that this was the path that I was to follow. Now, where does loyalty to come in such a thing as that? For one thing, we're loyal to the truth and to the light that exists within us. That comes first and foremost. And then when we find a teaching, when we find an avenue that represents that light and helps us to expand that light, then we stay loyal to that. That means to practice the teachings. That means to do our utmost to be of service, not just within a small group, but to the world at large. We seek to express that light that we have found within ourselves, that has been awakened within us. And through that loyalty to that light and to that truth, we grow in that light and we grow in that truth. Occasionally, some people come and I have opportunity to speak with them. And in a recent case, it's an individual who comes and he comes and listens a little here, and then he goes and he listens to another teacher there, and he goes and he gets another teacher there. And he dabbles all the way around. And he keeps on dabbling, and he keeps on drawing a little bit here and a little bit there. And he tests. He comes, he says, well, what about what this one says? What do you think about that? Well, in the beginning, that's all right, but this has been going on for well over a year. And at some point, you have to make a decision. You have to determine what your course is. And the time for dabbling comes to an end, because dabblers never get very far, you know? They just dabble. If you just take the spoon and you dip it a little bit into whatever you're eating, you just get a little bit of that. You just get a little taste of it. But you don't get the fullness of it. You don't get the fulfilling aspect of it. So for this individual, what God told me the last time that they came, is that they're being a spiritual vampire. They're coming and they're getting a little energy here. They're getting a little insight and consciousness there. But they're taking, but they're not giving. And because of that, what they're doing isn't right. It's not spiritually beneficial to themselves or to others. So it's very interesting. It's very interesting. And I say this as a means of pointing out the value of this loyalty. That when we discover the path that we can truly and wholeheartedly give ourselves to, then we are the beneficiaries of that. Because it is through this wholehearted turning over that we are able to fully engage in the Spirit, and we are able to fully receive it within us. Now, this connects in with this idea of shame, because it is also a part of separation. When we're not loyal to something, we hold back from it. and it is most oftentimes out of fear. And so when we give ourselves fully over to something, it is a risk. But our faith is, first of all, God within ourselves, that God will take care of us. He will guide us. He will lead us all the way along. And that as we give ourselves over fully, we gain the capacity for receiving fully. And this is the great advantage. And it is the one thing that if you read the lives of these saints, such as Ramakrishna, they gave themselves fully. They gave themselves over fully. Now, fears come up. Will I be able to work? Will I be able to have an income? Will I be able to maintain myself in the world? Will I be all right? Will I be consumed by this? Will I be destroyed by this? Will I end up in a terrible situation? All of those things are natural fears that come to us on the path. Everyone has them. Someone who's not meditating regularly, and you ask why, what would happen if you did? I'd advance further. I don't understand why I don't. And when you get down at the root of it, it's fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of being overwhelmed, fear of being overpowered. And because of that, fear becomes the dominant part of our lives. And that fear doesn't just leave, doesn't just go away on us. It stays with us. It moves in. It becomes our best friend. And that's a terrible state to be in, is to be living with that fear day to day, always on the run, always moving away, never embracing, never moving towards. And because of that, it stifles us. We come to a standstill in the spiritual path. Now, I've faced fear so many times, I can't tell you how many times. The reason I'm able to speak to you about this is because I've lived it so much. And all the obstacles and all the oppositions and all the ways that have pushed me against me. So I'm not trying to speak to you as one on high who's never had to deal with this. I've had to deal with it time and again. Fear of what other people think. I had an experience many years ago in meditation where I was sitting in meditation and suddenly my consciousness was transferred to the point above the city of Seattle. It's looking from Seattle out towards the Olympic Mountains. And suddenly there's a brilliant flash in the sky and then there is a tremendous crack. And in this vision, it was a nuclear weapon that had gone off right over the city, right out in the bay. And I felt the force of this terrific explosion coming at me. And believe me, I was in fear. And even though I was sitting on my meditation blanket, I was living this experience. My heart was beating fast. I had some perspiration going. I felt the full fear of this. Well, this vision returned to me many times over the next few years, and it gradually shifted and it changed. The next time it came the wonder, will I survive? Do I want to survive? Maybe I just want to be killed because I don't want to have to deal with all the after effect. I don't want to deal with being somebody who's been injured severely and in pain and all the rest of it, so I dealt with that level. And then the thought came to me the next time. Well, if God lets me live, there must be a purpose in that. Maybe I will be able to be of some help to others. And so, piece by piece, the fears came up, and I was somehow able to work my way through them. The last time that I had this vision, it came to me. It would come spontaneously at different times. I never knew when. It made sitting down for meditation an interesting task. And these are the kind of things that come up to us. And it's the reason why we start avoiding meditating and going deeper in is because these are the very kind of things that we're afraid of and that do begin either consciously or just under the conscious mind start to emerge. And we go, I don't want it, you know, and take this away from me. Let this cup pass from me. But these are the very experiences by which we purify the unconscious mind in order to become free of fear. The fears already reside within us. They're just being expressed through this vision. And the last time that this vision came to me, my perspective was once again over Seattle. I saw this brilliant flash, and this time I merged with this explosion in my consciousness, and I felt the power, and I felt the tremendous, expansive aspect, and it was my own consciousness that was expanding in that flash. And I felt the power and the freedom in that. And since that time, the vision's never come back. So it's not easy. It's not easy. But what do we gain from it? From those experiences, I was released from the fear of that particular, you know, when most of us were raised in a generation that we got underneath our desks when we were in elementary school because we were supposed to be preparing for an atomic explosion. I'm not quite sure what being underneath our desk was going to do to help us with some nuclear explosion going on overhead. But, you know, that's what we did. We were told where the bomb shelters were and that this could happen anytime. And I grew up in an area over by the Hanford where they had the radioactive reactors. And so there was radars around and there was underground silo missiles and all the rest of it. So it had a reality to it. And I remember looking out at these radar screens and knowing that they were there trying to detect any enemy missiles coming in. So this is the kind of environment that many of us grew up in. And because of that, it sows this seed of fear deep inside of us. There are many, many other aspects of fear. But what can be said of all of them, what can be true of all of them, is that they are impediments to our spiritual growth and understanding. And whether it's social fears or fears of calamity or death or fear of pain or fear of old age or fear of death, whatever it might be, we're on the battlefield. And when we're called to come to that battlefield, you see, Krishna is constantly urging Arjuna, you must fight the battle. You must get on the battlefield. I will assure you victory. If you just enter the battlefield, you see, that's a tremendous promise. We are assured victory if we step onto the battlefield. But if we withdraw, if we refuse, then the battle is delayed and delayed and delayed. And we live with it hanging over our heads, which is worse. I mean, the saying that a hero dies but once, but a coward dies 1,000 deaths. It's very true. When we live in fear of something, we die again and again and again and again. And life is miserable. But when we stand up and we say, I'm on the battlefield, and I'm assured that victory has already been created, and all I need to do is be here and do my best. Depend on that light. Depend on that light. You see, when Jesus called Peter out of the boat onto the water, Peter was looking right at the eyes of the Christ. And when he was focused on the eyes of the Christ, he stepped out on the water and he walked on the water. Then he started looking around him. He saw the waves and he saw the choppiness and he started thinking about how deep the water was there and that he was way out on the ocean and what in the world did he ever do this for? And he started sinking. And as he sank, he said, Lord, save me. And he looked back up. And he looked back into the eyes of the Christ again. And gradually he started rising back up again. And so with us, if we keep our minds on the divine, not on the troubles, not on the choppy waters, but keep our mind fixated on the divine, then that's what allows us to move through these experiences and move into the light and discover who we truly are. And when this light begins to emerge even as Ramakrishna's vision, first of like thousands of little fireflies sparkling everywhere around, with eyes open or eyes shut. And then great blazing light, and then waves and waves of light. You see, these are real experiences. I can tell you because I've had them, every one of them. And it gradually unfolds before your inner vision. And this light purifies the consciousness, it purifies the mind, it purifies the body. And you become a living manifestation of that light, no longer living in separation, and therefore without fear. And isn't that a marvelous place to exist? Imagine living without fear, completely reliant on the light within you, completely reliant on that divine consciousness as it flows through you, expresses itself through you. It doesn't mean that life is free of difficulties because you take on a larger aspect of helping the world. But what it does mean is that there is no separation, no fear. And your knowingness, your absolute knowingness that you are one with that spiritual consciousness is always with you. And because of that, you're free. Absolutely free. So let us go individually. Let us go collectively. Let us not be deterred by the fears that come up. They will come up. They will come up. But when you keep your mind focused on the divine, you will rise up out of the waters. And you will be able to walk upon the waters of consciousness where before you had sunk deep down in and become lost. You rise up and you are able to walk along the waters of consciousness. And you walk in that freedom and that light and that love and that bliss. And they are your constant friends and companions. Indeed, you are one with them. Wanted to read one thing that Mother had written, or rather had spoken. It's a transcript. Talking about her own loyalty towards Paramahansa Yogananda, her guru. I myself have been the recipient of the tremendous power of God in this man whom I call my master, my guru. Not in the sense that I was his slave, but in the sense that he was master of himself, and he came to teach me to become master of myself. And so, endearingly, I call him my master, my guru. And my love, my allegiance, my devotion for him was indeed great. And Mother always spoke of that allegiance and that devotion, that love. It's not for the individual, but it is for the light that comes within that individual. And indeed, that light expands out and out, and gradually you come to see it in every person, in every aspect of creation. And there is nowhere that you can look that there is not that light. And this is the fulfillment of the promise that the kingdom of heaven was within you, and it is here, and it is now. So let us march toward it with joy, with vigor, with fearlessness, as Papa always recommended to us. What a wonderful example of fearlessness, absolute reliance on the divine. Absolute reliance. And that's what gives us freedom from fear, is that complete faith and reliance. And you can take it from me, you can take it from these great spiritual masters, that your faith will not go unrewarded. see if there's any questions, comments about what I've spoken or on your sadhana. Certainly, yeah. And to visit other saints, it's a wonderful quickening and a privilege to do so. To visit the places where our master lived, Mount Washington down in Los Angeles, wonderful pilgrimage places. But the analogy that came to me once, it's like growing up in your home and then going to visit the home of some friends of yours. And as wonderful as the home of your friends, you would never mistaken it for your own home. And in that way, we have this special love, this special devotion for our own guru, for our own spiritual path and our line of gurus. But it doesn't mean that we don't honor and respect and love and take advantage of these other great masters and their inspiration and what they bring to us. But there is a virtue and there is a practical aspect to staying focused on those teachings, that this is the avenue that God has brought to us for our going towards God. If there are several pathways or several roads to go to a certain destination, we can travel down one pathway or down one road for a while and think, well, what about that other road? Maybe it's a little nicer or easier. And so we go over and we try that road for a while and we get down it a little while and we go, you know, the going's getting a little steep here. Maybe I'll try another road. Maybe it's a little bit easier. Well, the elevation gain is the same no matter what. And the price to pay to get to that destination is the same. And until we dedicate ourselves to that singular path and move all the way on that, then we'll always be getting down that road just a little ways and then going another little ways and then another little ways. And through all that effort, we'll actually go the whole distance that it would have taken us on one road to get to that path, but we're not any closer to that goal because we've taken all these little shortcuts, all these different paths all the way along the way. So it's not that we have to accept the first thing that comes along, but when we do find the right thing for us, then it benefits us to stick with it and go the whole way with that path. Right. So we find the path that best suits us. And when we find that, then that's what we pursue. Every one of us is endowed with free will. And we choose. We choose. And when we choose, the point is this, is that when we've made that choice, then we stick with that and we go with it the whole way. It's like starting at one university and going a year there, and then we bounce over to another university and not all the credits transfer. Few of them maybe, but not all of them. And then we go to another university and we lose more credits. And we're doing all this work, but we're not getting the most out of our time spent by switching from one to the other. And if we're switching subjects besides, none of the credits will transfer. And then it's almost as if we'd done nothing at all.
You know, David, that's what concerns me about if you don't make it in this lifetime and then you're reincarnated. You know, you have this good path going this lifetime and you're kind of on the right track. And you get incarnated into a different family on the other side of the world or whatever. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that? I mean, you know, you built up some good spiritual karma and you're, you know, you have a good consciousness and you're in a...
Well, Arjuna asked Krishna that very question. in fact, you know, is exactly put like that. And what Krishna says is that whatever effort and whatever virtues you gain in this lifetime will be carried with you into the next lifetime. And if you've generated a spiritual kind of personality, you will be drawn to spiritual parents. And if you're really lucky, you'll enter into households where they're practicing yoga. And with those good tendencies, you'll just pick up where you left off and you'll continue on.
Nothing lost.
Nothing lost.
But don't use that as an excuse for not making it this lifetime.
Because that tendency will follow you also.
That's right.
It's still something, oh, manana, manana, you know, I can always do this later. That tendency will carry over with you also. So whatever habit patterns you're building today, you're building your future.
You can take it with you.
Not only can you.
That's enormously reassuring.
Not only can you, you do. And that's both the good news and the bad news. So for those of us who have been pulled to this path, and because his mother said this is the path of the last mile, it's not for everybody, but it also indicates that we've done work along this path before. And when we come upon it, we, you know, Jesus said it this way, that the sheep know the shepherd's call. You hear that vibration, you hear those teachings, you go, yes. And as I said in the beginning, I still had a lot of questions, doubts went back and forth, but there was something about the call I couldn't deny. And that pulled me further and further and further along on the path.
It seems like if you ask most people why they're on this path, I mean in our little group, it seems like you always get the same answer, and that is that they don't have any choice.
There is that. I felt particularly in the beginning that I was being pushed onto this, and everything else was withheld. And I had some resentment about that. I didn't like that very much. I thought of it as a curse at one time. Why can't I be like everybody else? Why can't I be happy like everybody else with what they have? Now I consider that a great blessing. But at the time, I didn't always think so. But I couldn't think of anything else I'd rather be doing. There is nothing else I'd rather be doing. Okay. Let's do our closing prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he. Peace. Bliss. Amen.